Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. President-elect Donald Trump continues to put his White House transition team together. Kellyanne Conway, who was an advisor to the Trump campaign for president, is now part of that team. She's optimistic about making progress despite the protests that have occurred across the United States.
We're just working really hard to help form a government. President-elect Trump is receiving many phone calls, making many phone calls, receiving visitors, and focusing very much on assembling his core team.
Protests against Trump's victory of Hillary Clinton continued this Sunday throughout the United States, and there were protests like this.
We are the popular vote! We are the popular vote! We are the popular vote! We are the popular vote!
Demonstrators critical of the Electoral College system that allowed Trump to win despite balloting that still shows that Democrat Hillary Clinton had more popular votes than Trump. Meanwhile, the British and French foreign ministers will not participate in special talks with their European Union counterparts to discuss how to deal with the U.S. president-elect, who some European leaders have said does not understand the relationship between the U.S. and the EU. In a telephone discussion with her campaign donors, Hillary Clinton has blamed FBI Director James Comey for her defeat in the U.S. presidential election, saying his reopening of a probe into her use of a private email server broke the momentum of the campaign. Nearly every national opinion poll showed Democrat Clinton leading Republican challenger Donald Trump in the weeks leading up to the election. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Sunday for ministers to refrain from comment on Donald Trump's presidency after right-wing politicians said his election win put an end to a two-state solution with the Palestinians. This is VOA News. A powerful 7.4 earthquake has hit New Zealand, about 90 kilometers from the city of Christchurch, the biggest city on New Zealand's South Island. It was felt over 200 kilometers away in the capital, Wellington. The U.S. Pacific Tsunami Warning Center said there was no tsunami threat from Monday's quake. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage. However, the 6.3 quake in Christchurch in 2011 killed 185 people and caused widespread damage. The Iraqi military says it has captured the city of Nimrud that had been overrun with Islamic State militants. Iraq's Joint Operations Command, or JOC, said Sunday in a statement that the 9th Division of the Iraqi Army liberated the town of Nimrud completely. It raised the Iraqi flag over its buildings after the enemy suffered heavy casualties. Nimrud is near an ancient Assyrian capital that the Iraqi government said last year was destroyed by militants. It was not immediately known if the military had retaken the archaeological site. The United States has agreed to take in refugees from Australia who are being held in Papua New Guinea and Nauru after failing to reach Australia by boat. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull spoke about the agreement.
The agreement is with the United States. It is a one-off agreement. It will not be repeated. It is only available to those currently in the regional processing centres. It will not be available to any persons who seek to reach Australia in the future.
Asylum seekers who try to reach Australia by boat are sent to detention centres on the two Pacific islands and are permanently banned from resettling in Australia, even if they are found to be true refugees. Human rights groups have been highly critical of the living conditions on the islands. Colombia's government and its largest rebel group signed a new modified peace accord in Havana following the surprise rejection of an earlier deal by voters in a referendum. President Juan Manuel Santos and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia inked an initial peace deal on September 26th, amid international fanfare after more than 4 years of negotiations and more than 50 years of war. But voters rejected it on October 2nd by just 55,000 votes, dealing a stunning setback to Santos, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to end Colombia's conflict. South Korean prosecutors are likely to question President Park Geun-hye this week concerning a corruption scandal that has crippled her administration and sparked massive rallies calling for her resignation. An official in Seoul's prosecutor's office said they need to question the president Tuesday or Wednesday at the latest. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
National Security Services came to us and they said that they are closing down the station because on 13th of October, we carry a soundbite of Dr. Riek Machar, that is the former first vice president.
The South Sudanese government shut down the only independent radio station in the country.
In line with the Article 2 of the Constitution of the Zambia 2016, it obligates every person has a right and duty to defend the Constitution and resist or prevent persons from overthrowing, suspended or illegally abrogating the Constitution.
The leader of a major Zambian opposition party comes under pressure to resign for seeking to amend the party's constitution.
Money is not moving around and businesses are collapsing. People are losing their jobs. They always count the number of schools and the length of road they built. And we need more than that.
And Ghanaians go to the polls in December. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The only privately owned South Sudanese radio station was closed down by security authorities in the capital Juba on Friday. This after the station played a sound clip by former South Sudanese former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar. Local media reported that the National Security Service ordered the immediate closure of the iRadio station without providing a reason for the move. For more regarding the closure, I read Stephen Omiri, Chief Executive Officer of iRadio.
We went off air on Friday at around 11:30 a.m. African time. It happened because the National Security Services came to us and they said that they are closing down the station because on 13 of October, we carry a soundbite of Dr. Riek Machar, that is the former first vice president. And they think it was not good for us to run a story, the voice of Dr. Riek Machar, because he's outside the country. That was the main thing that we closed down. But in actual sense, we did not actually interview Riek Machar. Riek Machar spoke to journalists in the airport in Khartoum on his way to South Africa. And that was the first time he was speaking to journalists after he left Juba. So that's what we carry. We felt that at the station that this was something that was positive for the audience and the of South Sudanese to listen to something positive from Riek Machar. But then the government didn't like it. And because of that, we were asked to bring the soundbite. We gave them the soundbite. We gave them the text. And on Friday, they came and shut us down.
We understand there might be a possibility that on Monday, you could be allowed to begin operation. Has there been a meeting set up and have you met them ahead of Monday's meeting?
Yes, from Friday we have been in contact with the National Security and I think our communication had been positive. We have been having a very open and cordial discussion about the reopening of the station. So on Monday we'll be meeting with them and there's a possibility that we'll get back on air. So I don't know what will transpire in the meeting, but I'm very optimistic that based on the engaging from the discussion we had with them, that everything seemed to be very positive and we might go back on air on Monday, depending on how the meeting will go. But I want to remain positive because the trend of our discussion seemed to be more positive and more friendly and more cordial, even though we are off air. But again, the discussion seemed to be very good, a lot of respect, a lot of understanding. And I think if we continue that way, we might go on air on Monday. I'm not sure of what time will the meeting will take place, but most probably it'll be the morning hours.
I spoke with some Sudanese who listen to iRadio and they are of the opinion that since your organization is the only independent station, this action from the government could possibly suppress your views of giving independent information to them and that this could shake you down, basically not to broadcast anything that the government would find objectionable and close you down again. How do you plan to make amends or stay independent as you have been?
I think our independence has never been compromised. For we have been very independent for quite long, I think, and will remain to be independent, because this radio station has history in South Sudan. Actually, even in Sudan, the radio station started in 2003, and it was founded on the principle that there was no independent media in Sudan then. So the founder wanted to bring a media that is independent, that is fair, that is accurate, to be able to inform the people of South Sudan and the people of Sudan in a manner that is not compromised, in a manner that is not skewed towards the government. The 4 days that we are off-air is a big blow to the people of South Sudan, because we are the only independent radio station. We are the most listened to radio station. Because we don't play music, we are purely news and information service.
The government said that their broadcast was a security threat to the country. Some people are worried that they could use similar tactics in the near future, which will undermine or compromise your station's independence. How would you maintain your true independence following this action taken by the government?
It will be very difficult for me to answer that question, because I'm not heard from the government now. So it's hard for me to respond to what the government say. But what we want to do is we'll want to continue to remain independent, but also be mindful of the situation, because information that you broadcast on air can be misinterpreted by other people. From now on, we'll want to do an internal control system where we want to make sure that we are independent, but our independence should not step on the other people. Most probably, we have to look at our editorial policy and think, what are some of the things that put an issue problem with authority? So we want to know all the things and want to check whether these things, are they indeed of security interest or not? And so based on that, we'll be able to inform our story and news writing and our programming. But I will not be able to mention or react to the government, because I have not heard from the government and since we're shut down.
Stephen Omiri is the Chief Executive Officer of iRadio. He spoke with me from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. Meanwhile, a South Sudanese diplomat in Washington is hopeful that President-elect Donald Trump would continue to help the people of South Sudan. The chargé d'affaires at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington says there's no fighting and that the new U.S. administration should donate more money to his country. Ambassador Gordon Boy tells John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus radio show that his government needs assistance to develop South Sudan.
The Republican and Democratic policies on South Sudan are bipartisan. We believe that there will be no change. We believe that President-elect Donald Trump will continue giving money for the humanitarian purposes in South Sudan.
The U.S. assistance to South Sudan has been reduced to humanitarian emergencies. There's no money going direct to government institutions, because they're saying that you have to end the fighting in the country. Do you think this is going to end very soon?
Now we are in the implementation phase of the peace, and that we would want to deliver the services to the people. In that case, we would try to convince the president-elect that, look, yes, there is a need for humanitarian assistance, but the money could be divided into two. The half should go to humanitarian assistance. The other half should go for development through USAID, because now people need roads, they need services in order to settle. I believe there will be a change.
But the U.S. foreign policy is based on its principles of good governance, democracy, freedom of speech, accountability, and rule of law. And all these principles seem to be like a foreign language in your country. How are you going to work with the new administration?
No, those principles are there. When we talk about good governance is not something like a religion. It is something that has to be built through institutions. So now we set up the institutions under the peace agreement. Those institutions are the ones that will build these principles, and we are in the right track now, implementing the peace in order to realize democracy, good governance. Democracy will come during the election, and it is already in the peace agreement that after 2018 there will be election.
What about freedom of the press?
That we have so many newspapers in Juba. There is a freedom of the press. We don't even have a journalist in jail. We are better than most countries in the Horn of Africa in terms of freedom of the press. You can even, you are a journalist, you can decide. We are better than some countries that I will not mention for diplomatic reasons.
And how would you explain the recent development today where the national security went to iRadio and closed the radio station down.
No, we did not close it down. It was only for one day, because the problem was that they interview people we consider as terrorists. You cannot interview Osama bin Laden in American media or an American radio or American TV. So what the iRadio did was wrong, but it was only that day. Now that it's still working now, iRadio is operational.
iRadio is not on air, Ambassador Gordon Boy. I want us to tell facts. As we speak with you, the radio station is shut down.
Well, if it was just, as I told you, it was only that day and it will be operational. So I'm just telling you, as a representative of the government, we did not shut down the iRadio. We were only telling them that what they did by interviewing terrorists is wrong. We did not. There is no law that our government passed to ban them. It was only that incident. And I believe tomorrow they will be on the air.
Ambassador Gordon Boy is the chargé d'affaires at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington, D.C. He spoke with John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus Radio Show. The leader of the Zambian Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development has come under increasing pressure to resign. A section of the party accused Edith Nawakwi, presidential candidate in the last election, as planning to amend the party's constitution so she could remain leader. The opposition party plans its convention in December, where Ms. Nawakwi is said to want to use the meeting to amend the constitution. But opponents are calling for her impeachment ahead of the convention. For reaction, I reached Edith Nawakwi in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
First and foremost, I would like to state that Happy Chongo ceased to be a member of the Forum for Democracy and Development by his own conduct. We just heard him yesterday when we heard him on radio. That is still our lawyer. If you go on his website, you'll find that he's donned in PF colors, clearly stating that he's now a member of Patriotic Front.
Are you maneuvering to have a constitutional amendment of your party to ensure your perpetual stay as presidential candidate or leader of the party?
No, that is out of question. I want you to know that the party has not been to the convention from 2005. And the party had pre-arranged the date of 9th December to go to the convention. Any member of the party, in view of the convention, can make any proposals. It is Nawakwi has not made a single proposal for amendment of the constitution. Of course, the trustees have sat down and said, in the entire Southern African region, FDD is the only party whose constitution for the last 17 years has not undergone any review. And they've decided, and I have not been privileged with the information, because I'll get that at the next National Policy Committee meeting, that there was need and cause to make some amendments. If the clause on the two terms of the presidential term was one of them, it will be subject to debate by the convention.
I understand some members of the FDD are calling for your impeachment because of what they say are moves to make sure you stay in power, despite the fact that you will go to a convention. It's part of your plan to stay in power and not to have any challenger for that matter.
No, by the way, I want you to know that my Vice President, Ifumu Banda, who has been a member of parliament for the last 10 years, he was not available to support the party, not even in form or kind. Apparently now, this group of people are working with him and they have decided that I should not go to the convention. I have to prepare the party to go to the convention. Even if there's a new leader, our party is such that any member of the party can stand and no one can even raise an impeachment motion. No member of the party, including the president. The procedure is very straightforward.
Is it true that you are seeking another term which will make it a third term which will sharply go against the constitution? For which reason you are seeking to ensure an amendment of the constitution that will allow you to seek for a third term?
The problem is this, that these gentlemen, they basically subsist on causing conflict. You can see where they've come from. They came from UPND, they came from PS, they came from MMP. Wherever they have been as a trio, they cause problems. Now, when you ask me, is it true that you are seeking a third term? Third term means that you have been in office for two terms. Has the party been in office for two terms? No. We went to the convention in 2005. We are now going back to the convention for the second time since 2005. And these issues can be discussed at the convention.
If that is the case, Ms. Nawakwi, then they are saying that you have been ineffective as a leader of the party if people are going behind your back to cause such impersonation to undermine the party. What do you say to that?
No, how can you say to me that I've been ineffective when someone who's the person that wrote the Beko has been withdrawn from him? And it's only after he's lost the incentive that he becomes violent. I think there's a motive. And what they are saying is that they don't have access to the money. And by the way, they are saying that we spend money in the secretariat without consulting the party. You need to ask them, how much as members have they contributed? These people have not even contributed one penny to the party. So they cannot say that they are ineffective. The person who has been ineffective is someone who hasn't been to any constituents. I think you need to ask them, when did you join the party? You also need to ask them, the person you are supporting, has he been around? Have you ever even heard the name of Chifumu Banda, the vice president of FDC? You always associate FDC with the Edith Nawaku. When these people left, they left us as a party. I was just one member. The guard, and we have rebuilt the party for it to be on the international scene, for it to be known in Africa and the region. I am the one who has spent time and life going in the villages, canvassing, building branches. My vice has never even attended any party conference. So you can't say that they have been an ineffective. Unfortunately, we let in people who are behaving like honey badgers.
Edith Nawakwi is the leader of the Zambian Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, ActionAid Zambia has demanded that Rogers Muiwa, the parliamentarian who proposed the amendment of the recently adopted Zambian constitution, should step down with immediate effect. The group says Muiwa is a danger not only to the development of Zambia, but also a threat to the country's burgeoning democracy. For more about the demand, I reached Nalucha Nganga Ziba, country director for ActionAid Zambia.
I would like to state that in line with Article 2 of the Constitution of the Zambia 2016, it obligates every person has the right and duty to defend the Constitution and resist or prevent persons from overthrowing, suspending or illegally abrogating the Constitution. Therefore, as ActionAid Zambia, we are currently concerned with the motions that were moved by our members of parliament, the first one being inclusion of members of parliament in council. We know that according to the reports of the constitution-making process, which involved consultative processes in the national convention, sector group convention, as well as the provincial convention, they never proposed MPs to be part of the council meeting. This was for the reason that councils should run effectively away from having members of parliament in there. And by virtue of that, members of parliament are still ex-officials when it comes to them sitting in councils.
Well, but the Patriotic Front were giving the mandate by Zambians to rule, and that shows that Zambians repose confidence in the ability to rule. So wouldn't it be right that they propose an amendment because of the policies they convinced Zambians they would implement? Why the opposition?
For us, when the Zambian people give the Patriotic Front the mandate to rule when they won the election, it was on the basis that they had given the Zambian people the constitution. And one of the things we have been calling for as ActionAid and as civil society is that even whatever constitution-making process that the country undergoes, we need to a legal framework to protect the process in order to avoid piecemeal amendments. We did not want piecemeal amendments. We would rather have the entire constitutional document be subjected to a referendum as opposed to piecemeal amendments of what we are witnessing today. Because these piecemeal amendments, by and large, are serving the interests of a few individuals in parliament and mostly the members of parliament from the ruling government, because they are looking for jobs to be deputy ministers. These are some of the clauses which were removed in our current constitution.
What has been the reaction of Zambians so far regarding this?
The majority of Zambian people have welcomed this, have not welcomed this development. They feel that the Patriotic Front is taking them for a ride. in the sense that, yes, we agree that our constitution has a number of contentious issues, but the issues they have raised that they're proposing for amendment are not the contentious issues. So why do they want to remove clauses in particular which pertain to issues of accountability, to issues of transparency? Why are they rushing to remove those and not look at embracing them? Because we have not seen any contentious issues to do with not having deputy ministers and having the president declared after 14 days. So they need to tell us what the problems with those clauses are, because as Zambians, we have not seen any, we have not had any issues with those clauses.
Nalucha Nganga Ziba is the country director for ActionAid Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Ghana goes to the polls in less than a month for parliamentary and presidential elections. For VOA, Francisca Kakra-Forson reports for the vote may turn on the state of the economy, which is struggling despite the opening of offshore oil fields 6 years ago.
Ghana is heading to elections amid high inflation, rising public debt, and frequent power cuts that have gone on now for 3 years. It has been quite the reversal for a country that was in 2010 declared one of the world's fastest growing economies.
Money is not moving around and businesses are collapsing. People are losing their jobs.
Maximus Ametogo is a social media coach at digital marketing company Popout.
They always count the number of schools and the length of road they built. And we need more than that.
Massage therapist Hilda Harrison had to shut her business down this year.
At the moment, it's very bad because there's no money in the system. So if the person doesn't have money, how can the person call for a massage?
She said she will vote for change in the December 7th polls. The largest opposition party, the New Patriotic Party, NPP, says it will manage the economy better. NPP presidential candidate Nana Akufo-Addo says he will restore macroeconomic stability.
We have to recognize one thing. If we do not make a focused, systematic effort to change the nature of our economy, move it away from this raw material producing economy into an industrial value added economy, we are never going to address the issues of poverty, of higher income standards that we are all looking for. We must make that consistent effort.
But the ruling National Democratic Congress is defending its track record with its mantra, transforming lives. Certain factors in the economic downturn have been outside the government's control, like slumping global commodity prices. Ghana recently opened the valves on its second offshore oil field. The country is also a top exporter of gold and cocoa. President John Mahama has tried to reassure the country as he runs for re-election. He says the economy is stabilizing and that his government has cut the budget deficit in half between 2012 and 2015 and invested in the power sector.
This has led to stability in Ghana's cedi, which is currently said to be among the best performing currencies in Africa, and is said to be the best performing in West Africa outside the CFA zone. After stabilizing the economy, we expect Ghana to return to the path of accelerated growth starting from next year.
Economist Robert Dakwanse says that may be overly optimistic. The International Monetary Fund warned the government to hold down expenditures, but this year's elections have led to unplanned spending, and the government recently agreed to increase pay for striking nurses.
Clearly, if during an election year and for political expediency, we backtrack on some of these commitments that were supposed to help deal with the fiscal deficit and debt challenge, then we are shooting ourselves in the foot.
But ruling party supporters say continuity is what the economy needs to recover and that the president should get another term to finish what he started. Francisca Kakra-Forson for VOA News. Accra.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In the African qualifiers for 2018 World Cup, South Africa, Uganda, Nigeria, and Burkina Faso all recorded victories on Saturday as qualifying continued across Africa. South Africa inflicted the first competitive defeat on Senegal since January 2015, winning 2-1 to go second on goal difference in Group D behind Burkina Faso, who won 2-0 away to Cape Verde. Algeria also suffered their first competitive defeat since 2015 Nations Cup with a 2-1 loss to Nigeria. The Super Eagles have taken a 4-point lead in Group B after Cameroon were held to a 1-1 draw by Zambia. Uganda's recent resurgence continued with a 1-0 victory over Congo Brazzaville in Kampala to lead the Group E standings. In other matches, Mali drew with Gabon and Morocco drew with Ivory Coast in Group C. On Friday, the second round of group games got underway in Algeria, where the Group A match between Libya and Tunisia took place on security grounds. A penalty from Sunderland's Wabi Kazri was enough to give Tunisia a 1-0 victory and take them to the top of Group A with 2 wins out of 2. Libya are bottom of the group after 2 consecutive defeats. The other Group A game pits Guinea against the DR Congo, one of 2 African 2018 World Cup qualifiers on Sunday. The other Sunday fixture is between Egypt and Ghana in Group E. Only the 5 group winners will qualify for Russia 2018. In athletics, Kenyan runners dominated the 34th edition of the Athens Marathon, The Authentic, on Sunday. There was late drama in the men's race when Luka Rotich overtook fellow Kenyan Benson Kipruto with little more than 1 kilometer to go. In warm weather conditions with some wind, the 28-year-old Rotich took the race in 2 hours, 12 minutes and 49 seconds. Kipruto was second, while Andrew Kimatai completed an all-Kenyan podium. Kenyan Nancy Arusei ran a great marathon debut on the difficult course and outclassed the fading favorites. The 30-year-old won the race from Algeria's Kenza Dehamani, and Ornai Ruboli of Greece came through to take third. Our energetic Andy Edwards was in Athens and talked to Luka Rotich.
I'm with the winner of the Athens Marathon 2016, Luka Rotich of Kenya, who overtook the leader in the last kilometer. Luka, the background is noisy, everyone's celebrating. How did you do it? How did you win the race?
It was difficult, but just maintained the pace slowly, and the last minute I was able to have enough energy to run fast.
What do you think of the Athens course? Everybody says it's tough. Is it tough?
Yeah, it's tough. But I managed to win it. I thank God.
You've run 2:12, but do you think it's worth a lot faster on an easier course?
Yeah, I'll talk about run under 2:10, maybe like 2:6, 2:7.
What's your feeling of running in Athens, the historic course? What's your feeling of this Sunday morning, this race?
It's tough. That goes, but it's a good marathon. I tried, but I...
Congratulations, Luka. You have a great day in Athens. Thank you.
The authentic course is considered to be a tough one. It was held on the regional marathon course of the first Olympic Games of the modern era in 1896. A record entry of 17,500 runners entered the marathon. Early on Friday night, the Olympic marathon champions, Eliud Kipchoge and Jamina Samgong, as well as the former world record holder Haile Gebrselassie, were crowned at the Ames Gala in Athens, the birthplace of the marathon. While Kipchoge was unable to attend the ceremony and was represented by his manager, Samgong received the Best Marathon Run of the Year award, while Haile was honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award by Ames, the International Association of Marathons and Road Races. Finally, in tennis, Andy Murray enters his first tournament as the world number one when he plays the Barclays ATP World Tour Finals in London. The tournament starts on Sunday, but Murray doesn't play his first match until Monday. Murray was asked how it felt to be world number one, a position he has now held for 5 days.
It feels good, obviously, but I don't feel any different this week than I did the week before. Like, when I get up in the morning and stuff, I think, like, when you step on the court, you know, have, you know, a little bit more confidence, feel a little bit better about yourself when you're actually hitting balls. And feel much different when I woke up on Monday morning. Felt just the same.
Tennis world number one player Andy Murray speaking in London. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday on another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax, reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Do you always get it shaking your waist? The way you do, you always get it shaking your waist.
now. Give it to me harder. You know I want it now, now. Me not a can it just now, eh. So me now wait up who I shock on a gym, eh. Na butwele lo ya lo bite. Toko kete toko la lawa. DJ baki sa miziko katate. Toko kete toko la lawa. Na butwele lo ya lo bite. Toko kete toko la lawa. DJ mati sa miziko katate. Toko kete toko la lawa.
Baby dance in my cosa. The way you dance in my cosa. Baby dance in my cosa. Roberta dance in my cosa. The way you paddle your waist. You should do your waist. I'm moving your waist on me. The way you paddle your waist. You should do your waist.
Give it to me, can you bad? I'm loving the way that you shake.
Give it to me,
can you bad? I'm loving the way that you shake. Oh.
Cause me sugar boy, I could give you what you want. Oh, make you dance it dance. Oh, all the girls that like me, from Liberia to Congo. Hey, all the girls that like me, from Liberia to Congo. Baby, dance on my tongue. I wanna see you move to the beat.
Oh yeah, give me.
time to see that you are my angel. Everything I will need, girl, you got it. Times to what you're doing forever. Cause I want you forever. Yeah. Hey, give it all, yeah.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is understandable that a large number of Africans, like the rest of the peoples of the international community, were stunned by the results of the American presidential election held last week. The main reason was that all the opinion polls, and I must stress, even the internal polls of the two campaigns, the Hillary campaign and the Donald Trump campaign, all show that Hillary Clinton would become the 45th president of the United States. Why the failure? Most commentators are trying to compare the failure of the 1948 elections when it was predicted that Dewey will defeat the incumbent Democratic President Truman. And also, if you look carefully at the polls, the rush to judgment may not be fair. All these polls showed that Hillary Clinton would win the popular and national votes from between 2 to 5 points. It is now clear that when all the votes are total, Hillary Clinton would win the popular vote with nearly 2 points. The real problem was with the so-called battleground or swing states. But again, the polls were very careful. They noted that although Hillary Clinton was leading in these battleground states, the polls were tightening and that the final result would depend on what was called the ground game. That is, which campaign would be able to bring its supporters to the polls. Now, what happened was a surprise. With respect to the Republican Party, the white working class and rural areas turned out in extremely high numbers, some reaching 80%, which was not anticipated. On the other side, the African-American vote fell dramatically compared to the vote in 2012. It fell from between 10 to 16 points in different parts, and this may be a major factor. But there are also other factors that may have impacted on the result. One cannot discount the factor of the FBI letter to members of Congress 11 days towards the election. Data now shows that many Republicans who were hesitant to vote for Trump began to move towards him because they were fearful that Hillary Clinton might be indicted. Even the exoneration, which came 2 days before the election, only redoubled the efforts of the white working class. So this should be taken into account. Then the question now is, what next? Now, there have been a lot of speculation, I would say premature speculation, as to what will be Donald Trump's policy when he takes office next year, January 28th. The main reason for that is this. Donald Trump never produced during the campaign in any consistent policy papers, not coherent in any way. There were a lot of pronouncements on many issues, from the wall to the expulsion of Muslims to the question of getting rid of immigrants who are here illegally. But even his ardent supporters warned during the campaign that one should not take Donald Trump's pronouncement literally. And we are now even seeing, even at this early date, he began to switch his views on issues like Obamacare and many others. So one cannot take seriously what he said during the campaign to determine what his policy would be in next year. We also must take into account the reality of the constraints of office. What one says on the campaign trail may not apply when one is in the Oval Office. For example, we have a case now where the Democrats managed to gain 2 more seats in the Senate. They are therefore in the position to be able to obstruct any program of the president-elect that may go contrary to some of the policies and plans of President Obama. Then when you move further down, you'll see that many of those who voted against Trump are now demonstrating for the 4 times during the night, demonstrating against him. Why? Because there are many people of color who believe that they stand to lose a great deal during the presidency of Donald Trump. And also, one should take into account the fact that already there are reports of people being attacked many parts around the country. So what I would suggest to African colleagues is take a deep breath, relax, give Donald Trump the opportunity to collect himself and prepare for the presidency. If it turns out that he will carry all of the things he has said, there are many ways for which people will react. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaq Kasale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, in a court of fowls, the cockroach never wins a case. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals and entities as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. These include persons who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism, persons who have provided support or services to designated terrorists or in support of acts of terrorism, and persons who are owned or controlled by or act for or on behalf of designated terrorists. When such an individual or entity is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the list of specially designated nationals and blocked persons, the SDN list. Assets within U.S. reach in which the designated person has an interest are immediately frozen, and the designated person is locked out of the U.S. financial network. U.S. persons are generally prohibited from conducting business with a designated person. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. In a push to disrupt the operations, fundraising, and support networks of the terrorist group Hezbollah, on October 20th, the U.S. Department of the Treasury designated Mohammed al-Mukhtar Khalis, Hassan Jamal al-Din, Yosef Ayad, and Mohammed Galeb Hamdar. Also designated was Global Cleaners S.A.R.L., a business owned and managed by Adhem Hussein Tabaja. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia also designated Khalis, Jamal al-Din, and Global Cleaners S.A.R.L. Tabaja and portions of his business network were sanctioned by the Treasury Department last year. While employed by the Al-Inma Engineering and Contracting LLC, a Treasury Department-designated company owned by Adhem Hussein Tabaja, both Mohammed al-Mukhtar Khalis and Hassan Jamal al-Din provided financial services to Hezbollah. Yosef Ayad is an operative for Hezbollah's external security organization, which is responsible for planning, coordinating, and executing Hezbollah's terrorist attacks worldwide. Mohammed Galeb Hamdar is another external security organization member who was also designated for acting on and behalf of Hezbollah by assisting in the planning of and supporting acts of terrorism. 2 years ago, he was arrested in Lima, Peru, on suspicion of planning terrorist attacks there. Today's joint action with Saudi Arabia underscores the strength of U.S. and Saudi cooperation in disrupting Hezbollah's worldwide commercial and financial infrastructure, said Adam Zubin, acting Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. Hezbollah continues to plan, coordinate, and execute terrorist attacks around the world, and Treasury will continue to aggressively target Hezbollah and those supporting its terrorist activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.